Hi, I'm Bob Moon in for Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 6, 2011. As graduation nears, college seniors are on the hunt for work, but this summer the prospects for young adults are downright grim.
Job market's not looking that great, especially in education right now. It's not even close to being an open job market right now, so I'm actually going to do the travel thing.
We'll explore the youth job market. And during times of high unemployment, people want to know the most effective way to find a new job.
The principles are the same for everyone. Activity breeds income. You have to take risks to find a job.
We've got sage advice from a business and career coach. Plus, with spring here and summer just around the corner, have you made any travel plans yet?
So I would definitely look at Twitter as a way to find out about sales. And they are out there, absolutely.
We'll get tips on how to find the best deals on summer airfare. That story and more coming up, but first, the biggest hiring spree in 5 years. That's the word from the Labor Department this week. The economy added some 244,000 jobs. But that doesn't mean it's easy, especially if you're young and looking for work. The under-25s have an unemployment rate about twice as high as everyone else right now. When it comes to salary and job opportunity, or should we say lack of it, high school grads heading directly into the workforce have it worst. But it's a mixed bag for new college graduates trying to land that crucial first job. From Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
So how's the class of 2011 looking to employers?
They will hire approximately 20% more college graduates than they did the year before.
Edwin Koch of the National Association of Colleges and Employers says the market's decent this year, especially considering job offers fell more than 20% in the Great Recession.
While it's much improved, it isn't going to be at the level of 2007, where applicants actually had multiple offers. We're still at a situation where the average applicant isn't actually getting an offer.
Career Development Center, this is Darby.
I first met Darby Sism a year ago when I visited Loyola University Chicago. Her students were facing dismal job prospects. And this year?
Job postings have increased. We had slightly more employers on campus, but the students seemed to be responding as if there wasn't an increase.
Sism thinks the Great Recession of the mind still isn't over for her students.
They've heard the news, you know, the last couple of years. They know that their peers have had a really hard time. And I think a lot of them have just decided to do the, I'm going home to live with my parents and to look for something over the summer instead of stressing themselves out.
It isn't too hard to find the senior stress rising at the Career Center at Portland State University.
So do you think this is misleading?
If you actually took it from your previous job description, other words you could use, coach, train, educated, advise.
I'm Colleen Conklin and I'm 22 years old.
Conklin is 4 weeks from graduating with a bachelor's in psychology and she needs job help.
I started probably in about December when I started realizing how competitive graduate schools were and that I might want to take a year to make my resume stronger and get real life experience. And I've been putting them aside so that I can, but I'm a little late on doing the resume and cover letter.
And have you applied for anything yet?
No.
Conklin has plenty of company in the delay department.
Tickets are in here. Cap and gown is at the bottom floor of the bookstore.
Right. But they're supposed to have information about where, like, what's going on that whole day.
I met Jordan Augustet waiting in line to pick up commencement tickets. He's a sociology major and hopes to teach high school.
Job market's not looking that great, especially in education right now. It's not even close to being open job market right now. So I'm actually going to do the travel thing.
To New Zealand. There's a flip side to the millennial wanderer, 20-somethings who know exactly where they're headed career-wise, like Augustette's friend, Samantha Robel.
I am going to go study with a lawyer at my dad's firm, take the LSATs, and then I'm going to apply for law school. I actually want to be a prosecutor, and that's always in demand.
So your job plan is based on at least as much crime.
I'm actually hoping there will be more, so I have a better chance of getting a job. So awful to say that.
Not everyone is setting their sights quite so high.
I've been fortunate enough to be hired on at Nordstrom as a sales associate.
Amira Karim's first job in high school was at McDonald's. With her BA in communications, she'll do a marketing internship this summer along with the job at Nordstrom. Many of her fellow seniors don't have jobs at all.
As you all know, the anniversary sale begins in July, so I'll definitely be full-time at Nordstrom. I've put my foot in the door, and it keeps me correct financially, so I think I'm doing pretty okay.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Dig deep into this week's good employment numbers, and you'll find some bad news. The number of people who've just given up actually rose last month. In our ongoing series, The Job Chronicles, job counselor Belinda Dowdy has some tips on how to keep going, even when you want to just throw in the towel.
I've coached more than 6,000 job seekers in the last 10 years. Downsized executives, workers whose factories closed down, MBA students, people returning to school to train for new careers. The principles are the same for everyone. Activity breeds income. You have to take risks to find a job. Get out and meet people. Ask about their work and their careers. Get over the idea that networking is using people. Friends and family helping you is the best way to find a job, and people want to help. You'd be surprised who can answer your questions. I worked with a welder who lost his job. He went back to school. Then he went door to door in Siler City to every business that might need welders. He told them, "Hi, I've been welding for 20 years. I've just earned my certification at Wake Tech, so I know all the new techniques. Do you need welders? Do you know someone who does?" He was so personable and friendly that people wanted to help him. He found a job in 3 weeks and met a lot of people along the way. Tell everyone you know what kind of work you are looking for. Listen to other people's advice. Be prepared for an interview every day. Have your interview clothes ready. Be able to answer questions about your skills and experience and how you can benefit the company you are talking to. Follow up with people you talked with earlier. Keep in touch and share your news. Sooner or later, someone will tell you about a good job opening. Everything you learn will help you compete for it. When you get the job, thank everyone who helped you. And then, when they need your help, give that help generously.
Belinda Dowdy is a business and career coach in Central North Carolina. You'll find other installments of the Job Chronicles on our website, marketplace.org.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Well, a whole year has gone by, and they're still trying to fix the problems that sent Wall Street on that gut-wrenching roller coaster ride they call the flash crash. The Dow plunged by more than 600 points in a matter of minutes, only to bounce back an hour before the closing bell. Since then, regulators have imposed a few new rules aimed at limiting any wild trade swings, but many experts can't rule out that something like the flash crash could happen again. So we've been checking to see if there's anything the average investor might do to stay out of harm's way. Let's start with a quick refresher on what federal regulators think happened that day. Most of the trading on Wall Street is now done with pre-programmed computers, and when a big mutual fund decided to dump an unusually large sell order on the market, it triggered a wave of electronic trading. Georgetown University finance professor James Angel explains it was already a turbulent trading day.
Normally, the market could have handled an order that big, but the market was in just enough of a jittery moment that the big order caused prices to fall.
What we know is Wall Street is now spread so widely across many different trading locations that the tickers tracking all those prices couldn't keep up. That in turn led to a sudden shortage of buyers because professional traders checked out.
Their circuit breakers went off and they said, "Whoa, something's going wrong here. I don't know if it's my machine is bad or somebody else's machine. I better not trade." So the people who normally stabilize prices stepped to the sidelines. Other people kept trading, and that's where things went totally crazy.
Which brings us to the comparison I made here on Marketplace Money a year ago. If a roulette wheel goes haywire and the casino loses its marbles, all bets are off. But after the flash crash, the stock exchange has canceled only some trades, limited to a seemingly arbitrary loss threshold. And burned stockholders complain there are still no promises that won't happen again.
I feel like it's been swept under the rug.
Rochelle Rittmaster lives near Denver. She had thousands of dollars in stocks sold out from under her when the flash crash triggered something called a stop loss order. She wanted her shares sold if they fell below a certain value, but never imagined it could happen like this.
What was really a bum deal was that my trade wasn't reversed. Many others did have theirs reversed.
Now, as James Angel at Georgetown sees it, blindly triggering the sale of your stock with a stop-loss order is always risky. He suggests long-term investors can learn a lesson from a shareholder who just stayed the course.
At the end of the day, the stock had almost fully recovered, and if you looked at the change in price from one day to the next, it wasn't that big a deal. Unless you are trading at the very moment the glitch occurs, you're not going to be affected by a temporary glitch.
Unless that is, you've set up an automatic sell trigger. Ridmaster insists her stop-loss order made sense for her, and she complains the real problem is a year's gone by and investors still have to worry their money could be snatched away for no good reason.
It doesn't have to be anything fundamental. It doesn't even have to be the emotions of the market for the day. It can merely be a bunch of algorithms started to be set off, and there you go.
Ridmaster has an ally in MIT finance professor Andrew Low, who agrees that she and other innocent investors shouldn't have suffered the losses they did from what was clearly a technical glitch. He says investors need to pressure their lawmakers in Washington to beef up consumer protections and their legal recourse against Wall Street.
You know, the large investors can deal with these kinds of glitches in various different ways, including legal remedies the small investor doesn't have access to.
Ted Weisberg at Seaport Securities has been a broker on Wall Street almost 50 years. He's also critical of government regulators for leaving out the little guy.
The government basically keeps changing the rules to satisfy the professional trader or the high-frequency trader at the expense of the public.
The rush from human floor traders to ever-faster computers may have been well-intentioned, Weisberg says, but the flash crash is only one of the unintended consequences.
I think in general that speed kills, just like in automobiles. And I just think we need to slow things down a little bit. We need to give people a chance to be able to make decisions based on what's going on around them. And all the systems in place today make it faster and faster and more confusing and more volatile.
But they've also made things easier in other ways, says MIT's Andrew Low.
Trading has never been cheaper, faster, and more efficient for the typical investor. So individuals have really benefited from this technology most of the time.
That's small comfort for investors like Rochelle Ridmaster. Despite her losses in the flash crash and her bitter distrust of Wall Street, her retirement money is still invested in the stock market.
I am solely in it because it's the only game in town. It reminds me of there's a Woody Allen joke in the movie Annie Hall. This guy says to his doctor,
"My brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "Well, why don't you turn him in?" And the guy says, "I would, but I need the eggs."
So I feel like I'm kind of in that situation. I still need the eggs.
For more on the flash crash, go to our Makin' Money blog at marketplace.org. Certified planner Ross Levin talks about the financial insight he received from his twins. More Americans than ever are accepting jobs overseas, and that often means relocating the entire family.
This time was the first time that we actually had someone come to the house and talk to us about what it would be like to live in a new country.
Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. It's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is personal finance expert Liz Weston. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Bob.
I'd like to start by asking about this new attempt to answer the question of why so many homeowners are willing to walk away from their mortgages, even, it seems, if they're able to keep paying, but strategically they decide why bother. You know, a while back, I interviewed Carl Case on this subject. He's one of the names behind the much-followed Case-Shiller Housing Price Index.
Yes, yes.
And he confirmed there does seem to be less of a moral obligation to keep up with your part of the contract.
You see these big deals and banks getting bailed out, it makes you a little less sympathetic than you'd otherwise be for a bank to whom you have the obligation. People say, if the big guys can do it, why can't I?
So what about that, Liz? Is there something to that, or does this new study shed any more light on this?
Well, there's a couple things going on. One is that strategic defaults seem a lot like the flu. You know, if you see your neighbor doing it, you are more likely to consider it yourself. That's been established. Mm. And I think what is going on is a lot of people are looking at, they are deeply underwater on a home. They are not going to get back their equity anytime soon, and their credit will probably heal before they would actually get back to their beginning, get back to what they paid for the house. So they are making a very strategic, well, there's a reason it's called strategic default, they're making a very strategic decision that, no, I'm just going to, you know, fold my cards. I'm going to give in on this particular investment. And that's how they look at it. It's an investment. It's not just a home.
But this is a risky strategy, right? I mean, how do we know how long you're going to take a hit to your credit score, for example?
Well, that's actually what we do know. That's the portion that's pretty much solved. If you have a very high credit score, it will take you about 7 years to get back to where you were. If you have a lower credit score, interestingly enough, it doesn't take as long. After a foreclosure or short sale, you'll be back to your 680 score on a FICO scale of 300 to 850. You'll be back in about 3 years. So the interesting thing that we're finding is Fair Isaac's been looking at who is more likely to default, trying to give this information to the lenders. And what they're seeing is that strategic defaulters are more likely to be a little bit more sophisticated. They tend to have higher FICO scores. They tend to have less debt, and they tend not to have been in the home that long. So if those conditions are present, Fair Isaac is telling the lenders, you might want to do something about this, keep an eye on it. What the bank actually does is going to be up to them.
Yeah, now Fair Isaac is the outfit that came up with the credit score, right?
Yeah, they are the ones that developed the Credit Bureau FICO score, which looks at, you know, your information at your credit bureaus.
Now, if they're the ones doing this study, it would stand to reason that the lenders and the credit risk managers are the ones that we're trying to get the answers here. How are they going to use this information?
That's the big question. Are they going to step in and say, look, you know, we will modify your mortgage for you if you stay? Or are they going to move faster on a foreclosure? I really don't know. It's probably going to be up to the lenders how they use that particular bit of information. And it will be kind of interesting if they guess wrong and they start approaching people who were perfectly content to pay the mortgage and say, you know what, you know, we can modify your mortgage for you.
The power of suggestion.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Okay, let's head to the phones. We have Holly calling from Iola, Kansas. Hola in Iola, Holly.
Hello.
What's your question for us?
Well, I've been really working on getting my finances in order this year. So one of the first things I did was order my free credit reports. And I have an account on there that is a credit card my parents have, and I'm listed as an authorized user, but I don't have a card for it anymore. There's really not any reason for me to be on there, except that it does give me a really long credit history and a higher credit limit than I would otherwise have.
Dating back to when, Holly?
It started, I think, when I was 3, when the account was opened.
Okay. So, were your parents deliberately trying to build a credit history for you, or did you just like to run out with plastic in your toddler tiara?
Well, it started as, you know, an emergency credit card when I started driving. So I used to have a card for it, but I haven't for the last, you know, 5 or 10 years.
Well, what about this, Liz? Is this common for people to put others on their credit card to give them a credit history?
Yeah, actually, it's called piggybacking, and it's been going on for quite a while. There was a time when some websites were sort of exploiting this and actually selling the authorized user slots on people's credit cards, you know, with their consent, to complete strangers that were trying to rehabilitate their credit.
So it doesn't affect the credit score per se, but it does give you at least a history.
Oh, it can definitely help the credit score.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if for example, her parents have been using this card all those years and using it responsibly, that positive credit history is imported into the daughter's file. So it's showing up and it's definitely contributing positively to her score.
So this is something that Holly wants to keep on her record then?
If you are in credit score improvement mode, I definitely wouldn't have yourself taken off as an authorized user. Why were you thinking of closing it down?
At the end, it lists my parents' address as one of my addresses, and I moved a bunch of times in my 20s, so I didn't know if that would be an issue.
No, actually, that people get all freaked out about things in their credit report that make no difference whatsoever. Addresses are one of them, a slightly misspelled name. What you don't want in your credit report are accounts that aren't yours. You need to be very careful if they're listing a Social Security number that isn't quite right. You might want to correct that. But stuff like an address, an old employer, things like that, you don't have to worry about at all.
I wonder, though, if it comes to the dark side of this. Apparently, Holly's parents have good credit, but what if her parents didn't have such good credit? Would you want to then get it off your credit report, and how would you go about doing that?
Absolutely. Now, the nice thing about this is if you're taken off as an authorized user, that history with the card completely disappears. But you do have to get the parents to call the credit card issuer to do that.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Holly?
It does. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to Ginny, who's calling from Denver. Hello, Ginny.
Hi.
What's your question for us?
Well, I own a couple of rental properties in Memphis, Tennessee, and one of the properties has been losing money ever since I acquired it. And I feel like at this point it's sunk most of my personal savings, and I'm curious to know if it's worth just kind of holding on and continuing to float that property with my personal income for the benefits 30 years down the road, or to go ahead and sell it now, given that I probably will have to sell it for much less than I paid for it.
How did you decide to start owning rental properties?
It was really a strange series of events. I was a teacher. I had a summer off. I decided to take a real estate class so I can see if being a realtor was something I wanted to do. And in that class, I met a person who was getting into it for investment reasons, and one thing led to another. And I actually have had a lot of success with the other properties. I think I just jumped into it so quickly, literally in the span of 2 or 3 months in a summer vacation.
What kind of property is this, Ginny? And is it in a good part of town, bad part of town?
Yeah, no, it's a pretty questionable part of town, I think. And that's part of the reason why I'm losing money on it, because I don't get like the greatest tenants, and there's a lot of high turnover, and it's a single family residence of like 6 bedrooms, actually. So it's quite large, but not ideal.
What about it, Liz?
Well, Ginny, let me ask you, why did you buy it in the first place?
I think I was jumping into the investment property game a little quickly, and so it was my first purchase. I wasn't fully informed. I wasn't totally familiar with the area, and so I do think it was a bad purchase, and it was pretty reasonable given that it was a foreclosure and I could get what I thought would be like really great rent on it, but mm-hmm. I have since learned that that was not a great idea.
Oh, yeah. Now, did you get a mortgage when you bought this property?
So I bought it with a hard money loan at first to finance repairs, and then I refinanced it with a permanent mortgage from a bank so that I could pay that hard money loan back, and so that's what I'm paying down now, the long-term loan.
And are you above water or underwater on that mortgage?
I am underwater.
Okay. Here's the thing. If it were in a great neighborhood and you know, housing prices were coming back, you might want to hang on because you'd be kicking yourself for selling, you know, at this point.
Right.
The problem is not a great situation in terms of the neighborhood, not a great situation with tenants. Single family houses are tough. You know, you basically either have it rented or you don't. Mm-hmm. And it's not like an apartment complex where if you have a few vacancies, it's probably made up by the fact that everything else is rented. So
you got some traffic there.
You got some traffic. And so it's, you know, and the fact that you're losing, are you losing money on it, even including the tax benefits, the depreciation and all that?
Yeah, okay. I would say the amount of money I have to put in on a personal level supersedes what I'm getting back in terms of tax benefits at the end of the year.
One of the basics of investing in rental real estate is to make sure that it's cash flow positive, so you're actually getting money out even before you take advantage of the tax benefits. The fact that even with the tax benefits, you're sinking. You know, I don't know what the real estate patterns are going to be. And that's, we were talking about this earlier, is that the one big unknown is when our housing prices coming back, and it's going to depend on the market. But I can pretty much guarantee you the bad parts of town are going to come back last. So
right.
It's probably going to be even longer before you have that hope. So, you know, this was an investment that just wasn't well considered. It's going bad. It's making you poorer every single month. It's probably time to pull the cord on this one.
Right. Well, no, this is really helpful. Thank you so much for the advice.
Good luck, Ginny.
Thanks, Ginny. Appreciate your call.
Thank you. Take care.
Finally, we have Chris in Kansas City, Missouri. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
What's your question?
Okay, so I have a collection company that took me to court and served me at an address that I lived at 3 years ago. And now I stumbled onto it just by happenstance. I was looking for something else for another person, and I was like, well, let me check my own name and see what's there. Anyway, and long story short, it has already gone to, you know, the judge and everything, and has a default judgment, and they have a garnishment against me, which hasn't been taken out yet. But when I went down to the courthouse, because I, you know, I saw that, and I went down to the courthouse just as fast as I could to talk to the local courthouse, and they said, yeah, you're going to start getting garnished probably this first payday.
Now, you're telling me you've been living in blissful ignorance all these years?
Yeah, kind of, sort of, yes. 7 years ago, I moved away from my hometown, and things didn't work out, so I moved back to my hometown in Kansas City. And during the time of things not working out, I defaulted on my credit cards. And basically, when I moved back, I didn't change my address because, you know, I didn't really want any more phone calls to collect or whatever at that point, because I didn't have a job yet then either.
Mm-hmm.
And then I literally did just forget about it. I mean, this is a debt from almost 7 years ago as of June.
What about it, Liz? You can run, but you can't hide.
Well, that's the thing. There's been a real big and growing market in old debt because a lot of companies have figured out that they could, you know, buy these debts for maybe a quarter of a cent on the dollar. We're talking tiny, tiny amounts. And if anybody pays them any amount, they're making a profit. Well, that was the beginning of the return of zombie debt, as we like to call it. And then law firms got into it, and law firms realized that they could file these lawsuits. A lot of jurisdictions, they can be very sloppy about how they serve the summons, so the people who are being sued don't even know about it. The judgment comes down, and they don't discover it until the wages have been garnished. Did you do any research into the statute of limitations on where were you when you incurred this debt?
I was in Missouri at the time, and then I moved to California, but I didn't even use the credit card there because I pretty much defaulted on it when I got there.
I see. Okay.
Does that make sense?
I heard him say 7 years. That sounds like a magic number of some sort.
It's only a magic number in terms of reporting it on your credit reports.
Ah, okay.
And then this is the big deal. The real statute of limitations in this case is how long the creditor has to sue you, and that varies. And I don't have Missouri's statute of limitations at the tip of my tongue, unfortunately. I know in California for a credit card debt, it would only be 4 years. They couldn't sue you after that period. The problem is, again, you have to show up in court if you are sued and let the court know, look, this is an out-of-statute debt. They're not allowed to sue about it. So I wish there were a faster way out of this, but you really do need to talk to an attorney that's familiar with the credit laws in Missouri. And there's a group out there called the National Association of Consumer Advocates, NACA.net. And just run it past him to see if there's – I mean, obviously you owe this money, but in the normal course of events, you could have settled it for a lot less than probably what they got, because I'm guessing when they got their default judgment, they not only got the original amount you owed, they added a bunch of interest and fees, and, you know, they really padded it up.
Yeah, it's $1,400 now, and I know for a fact that the credit limit on that card was not even $1,000 when I had the credit card.
Right. I should have asked you about the amount first because, you know, I thought we were talking about thousands of dollars.
No, we're only talking about $1,400. We're not even talking about a lot of money.
Well, one of the things you can do is to contact the collection agency and offer a settlement. Now, you can't undo what's been done to your credit report. You've got, you know, the judgment on there. Which is going to affect you for a while.
I'm curious, though, when you say that it would affect his credit report, it's because of the judgment, not the initial bad credit card debt. In other words, that's 7 years old, so that ought to fall off of a credit report.
Yeah, it's typically 7 years and 180 days from the time you first defaulted on the debt. So if he went and pulled his credit reports, it might not even be there.
Uh-huh.
But the judgment is a more recent event. And I'm racking my brain now for if that's I believe that can stay on as well for 7 years. Personally, I would just settle it if you possibly can. See if they're willing to play ball a little bit. Most collection companies are more than happy to have a lump sum in hand rather than a string of payments over time. So you at least have that. And then you can put a button on this and recover from it.
Yeah, for this amount of money, Chris, it sounds like it's time to get them on the phone and negotiate, huh?
Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
That's all the time we have for today. If you have a financial question, tell us all about it at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz, thanks for the great advice.
It's my pleasure, Bob.
And remember to check with a professional before you make any big money decisions.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Jen Real, and I live in Austin, Texas. Well, I actually found this wallet at a little store in Austin, and it's red, and it's got some pictures of owls on it. There's two credit cards. There's a couple of random cards from different restaurants and so forth. This one's right by my house. It's a great little walk-up taco joint. It's called Taco Mex. Got a lovely picture of a gentleman with a beautiful mustache holding a drink and a taco, and what looks to be like an alcoholic drink, although they don't serve alcoholic drinks at that, so it's a little misleading. Oh, and I have a member card for Car2Go. Basically, this is my access to 200 or 300 different smart cars here in Austin. With this card, I can walk up to any smart car and scan it, and it will let me in. I can drive off. It charges me 35 cents a minute. And I recently sold my car and decided to just be able to get around via bicycle.
And Austin's a great place to bike. Of course, now it's getting really hot, so we'll see how I feel in June.
And now, a nod to a special day this weekend.
Mother's Day is the day everybody gives their mom presents.
Just how do you put a value on everything your mother's done for you? From maternal guidance...
What do you do if a stranger asks you what time it is?
Say it's daytime and run.
Good.
To financial advice.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Actually, I'm not sure that was financial advice. Well, my mother always said, if you want something bad enough, save up your allowance. Now it seems appropriate that I saved up my allowance to buy her that Mother's Day gift.
Honey, look, the boys sent me flowers for Mother's Day.
Hey, Mom.
Can we borrow $10 for a Mother's Day pizza?
Yeah, we spent all our money on this box of flowers.
And this year, Mother's Day spending could reach over $16 billion. The average American is expected to shell out about $140 on a gift.
My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
I know what you're probably going to get. The National Confectioners Association says we buy around $500 million of candy around Mother's Day, and we'll spend another $2 billion on flowers.
Mother, there is no other like mother, so treat her right.
Of course, if you're a cheapskate and just don't love your mama that much. Kidding. Look for some free ways to celebrate the occasion with some tips from wisebread.com. You can find them at marketplace.org/money.
Mama! Mama! Ma! Ma! Mom! Mom! Mama!
What?
Hi.
Last week, we looked into the cost of owning and maintaining a car. Now we'll explore the flip side.
Despite the office scorn, I have reasons for riding 15 miles a day from my house in South Pasadena to downtown Los Angeles.
Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Sending an employee to live and work abroad is an expensive proposition for any company. The number of international assignments dropped during the downturn, but a recent survey predicts the number of jobs abroad will rise 50% in the next 10 years. Now, it used to be that family, if there was one, tagged along and made the best of it without much help from the boss. But these days, there's a good chance they might get some help up front. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Richard and Kim Choi knew life in China would require some adjustment. Richard works for a U.S. automaker. The company moved the couple and their three kids from Miami to Shanghai almost 3 years ago. But a trip to the grocery store can still bring surprises. Kim shows her 8-year-old son, Hanson, a tank of live turtles.
Why did they get them but put them in water?
So they stay nice and fresh, because people like to eat them. Look, these ones are turtles in a bag for making turtle soup.
He and his sisters are also grossed out and fascinated by the hairy crabs, snakes, eels and jellyfish writhing nearby. Kim says local meat is also quite a change.
Here, you know, it's the whole chicken, including the feet and the heads.
At least Kim and Richard knew what to expect. Richard's company hired a consulting firm to prepare them for the cultural shift. The couple has already lived in Dubai, Israel and Germany. Still,
this time was the first time that we actually had someone come to the house and talk to us about what it would be like to live in a new country. You know, we learned about Chinese history and business practices.
Rich is leafing through a manual they got before they left. It covers everything from Chinese proverbs and how to address people properly to office life.
There was a very large section on the corporate culture and how to behave in the workplace.
He had to take a survey to see how well his work style would mesh with the Chinese one. He did pretty well. Kim, a stay-at-home mum, had her own cultural compatibility test.
I learned actually that my personal space is quite important to me, which was the one area that was of a concern to the consultant, simply because in China there is no such thing as personal space.
By now, as a white woman, she's used to strangers coming right up to her and staring, or demanding to know why one of her kids isn't dressed warmly enough. Joe Donnell is with Cartus, an international relocation company that provides cultural training services. She says there's good reason companies spend anywhere from $1,000 to several thousand dollars on this type of training for employees and their loved ones.
Family adjustment is far and away the biggest reason that assignments fail. And if you think that international assignments can be in excess of $1 million for companies, they are going to need to mitigate that opportunity for failure.
It's often the employee's spouse, usually a wife, who has to deal with day-to-day problems. Some consulting firms devote themselves entirely to supporting the spouse. Therese Gavin works for a company called REA. It helps the employee's other half find a job or volunteer work.
If the spouse is happy, then the employee is going to be more productive in their work.
Gavin speaks from experience. She's accompanied her husband on two assignments, one in Germany, the other in China. The couple returned to Michigan last year, and that's when another adjustment began, being back home.
Sometimes it's just difficult in conversations, you know. You can't constantly be talking about your experience overseas, but you also sometimes, like, I don't really want to hear about everything right here anymore either. You know, you really kind of have a global eye.
She says they're drawn to other people who've lived or at least traveled abroad.
10, 9, 8, 10, 6.
Can you do that in Mandarin?
In Shanghai, the Choys are a couple of years away from returning to the US. Richard says they've pretty much adjusted to life here.
Once I stopped worrying about paying $8 for a bag of tortilla chips, it's like, okay, well, you know, we're here now.
Shanghai feels like home. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
If I may be so bold as to suggest the most popular summer pastime might no longer be baseball, but instead throwing spitballs at the air travel industry. A lot of us are convinced it just gets worse every year. It's been a year since Congress made the Passenger Bill of Rights official. So how are we all, faring? Here to help us figure that out is George Hoboka at airfarewatchdog.com. George, thanks for traveling our way.
Good to talk to you again, Bob.
Has the Passenger Bill of Rights made things better? It's been in place for how long now?
Well, honestly, I don't think that that legislation affected that many people. I mean, it grabbed a lot of headlines, but the truth is that it was just a minuscule percentage of passengers who were stuck on a tarmac more than 3 hours. And I think there are a lot of rules that, especially in this latest round of DOT regulations, that are headline grabber rules, but they don't affect that many people.
Yeah, the government recently announced these new provisions, mostly about hidden fees. I can never figure out exactly what I'm going to pay until I actually hit the last button. What do these new rules require from the airlines regarding fees?
Well, one really good rule that's probably going to affect a lot of people, and it's another one of these headline grabber regulations, is that the airlines have to place all of their fees, any kind of fee, even for pets or not just luggage, but food, on one page on their website. And there has to be a link from the homepage to this fee page. It's something that Ryanair in Europe has been doing for a very, very long time. You go to Ryanair.com and you'll see a link called fees, and you go to the fees, and they're not shy about those fees. There's a list of about 20 different fees, including for lap children, for example.
Now, the airlines didn't do this without kicking and screaming. I noted in one of the stories I read that Spirit Airlines compared this to being akin to McDonald's being required to only advertise burgers, including the price of fries and a Coke. Is that fair?
Everyone who advertises any kind of product or service, and not just in the travel industry, they never include all the fees. You know, your mobile phone company doesn't do it. Cruise lines don't do it. Rental cars don't do it. Hotels don't do it. Why is the DOT going after the airlines alone? So, I mean, I think the airlines do have a gripe there.
And when do these new disclosure rules take effect?
The new rules come into effect 120 days after publication in the Federal Register, whenever that is. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the airlines try to contest some of these rules. Some of these rules affect a lot of people, and some really are just what I call headline grabbers, and they only affect a few.
What's the state of getting there by air heading into this travel season compared to last?
Well, definitely airfares are higher, but there have been some what I call pop-up sales. For example, from almost every major hub to Honolulu for summer travel went down to $3.91 round trip, including all taxes. It's also good for winter travel. So there are pop-up sales that happen. It's just that they disappear very, very quickly. That's why we call them pop-up.
It also seems to me that carriers are starting to hide their discounts as well. I'm going to New York soon, and here's the way I got a good fare with help from airfarewatchdog.com. I caught wind of a promotional offer that was going on with this particular airline, but I had to go to a website, sign up for something there in order to get a special code to use for a discounted fare, and I got 30% off the fare. It was a really valuable code. Are you seeing more of that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely, Bob. I think the airlines are really trying to drive traffic to their sites so they can eliminate the middlemen being sites like Kayak and Expedia and TripAdvisor and others.
But you really need to look for these things. They aren't flashing in big red lights on their website. Sometimes they're on other sites.
You've got to sign up for the airline's email alert streams, and that's how you find out about them. So you go to the airline website, and you'll see, you know, sign up for our emails, and then they send you discount codes and promotions. I just tell people to sign up for airfare alerts. I mean, Airfare Watchdog sends them out. There are many other sites that do it. Bing Travel does it. TripAdvisor Flights does it. Travelocity, Expedia, Hotwire, they all send out airfare alerts. And the best way, though, is absolutely to sign up for tweets. Tweets are much faster than any other method. Email, unfortunately, can be slow. When you have millions of emails that you have to send out, your servers can get clogged, and by the time you see the email, the sale is gone. So I would definitely look at Twitter as a way to find out about sales. And they are out there, absolutely. They just last for a few hours or sometimes a day, and then they're gone.
Bottom line is be alert and be prepared to spend your money.
Be alert and shop a lot.
George Hobica of AirfareWatchdog.com, thank you very much for your insight.
It's a pleasure.
A lot of states are strapped for cash these days, and they're looking to a new source of income, forgotten money that you may have left behind. They can claim the interest while your unclaimed dough sits around. Let's get some tips on how to make sure you get what you've got coming to you from Valerie Junt at Keen Unclaimed Property. Welcome.
It's great to be with you today, Bob.
Now, I assume that if there is an outfit with unclaimed property in its name, that there must be a lot of unclaimed property out there. What exactly is unclaimed property?
Unclaimed property consists of any outstanding liability or personal intangible property that has gone unclaimed by the owner after a specified period of time. So in layman's terms, it could be a dormant bank account, insurance proceeds, outstanding payroll, might be oil and gas proceeds, dividends from stock that you own and you didn't cash the dividend check, even rebates. That's a real big one right now, too, and unredeemed gift cards. Could be a utility deposit that you didn't cash. The only tangible items that the states collect are items in safe deposit boxes. So if you don't pay your rent after a certain period of time and they have to drill the box, those contents will go to the state.
Now, how do people lose track of their property like this?
It really varies. And the stories, I've been doing this for over 28 years, it really does vary. Sometimes they just forget about it. They move. They don't keep their records up to date and don't provide those that their new address information to their financial institutions or other businesses that they do, you know, business with.
Is this a case of finders keepers, sort of? I mean, if the states take control of this property, is there a limit to how long they hold on to it before they just go ahead and seize it?
With the exception of one state, and that state is Idaho, all of the states hold those funds in a perpetual trust fund. So regardless of how old and how long the states have had that money, it's one place to look for your money, and they hold it in a perpetual trust fund until it is claimed by the rightful owner for the revenue.
So what's the best way to make sure that you don't leave any money unclaimed?
Well, obviously, nobody knows your business better than you do. Just make sure that you keep all of your financial records up to date. Make sure that if you've moved or in the process of moving, that you give them a good address.
How do you go about finding out whether you have some unclaimed property sitting around somewhere?
There are two sites that you can look to. One is the unclaimed.org, not unclaimed.com. Make sure you know the difference. Unclaimed.org is run by the National Association of Unclaimed Property Administrators. It's a free website. From there, you can link to every single state. Missingmoney.com is another one. Not all of the states participate on missingmoney.com, but it's another free site that you can look for your name and address as well.
We'll put the links to those search sites that you mentioned on our website, marketplace.org. Valerie Junt at Keen Unclaimed Property, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you today, Bob.
Last weekend, we took Marketplace Money on the road, literally, from the interior of Tess's car.
For this remote broadcast about cars, the second most expensive purchase you will ever make aside from a house, me and my backseat drivers,
which don't have to stay in the slow lane the whole time,
are on the long and winding road from Los Angeles to station KPCC in Pasadena.
Well, we're glad to say lots of you wrote us about how much you enjoyed our journey, but Leslie DiPietro, among others, chimed in with a note of disappointment. You didn't discuss one American-made car, except for the Jeep Wrangler, which you trashed. And she added, couldn't you at least make mention of a gas-saving, highly reliable Ford Escape or the brand-new Chevy Volt? A few listeners pointed out a misspeak in John Raby's piece about using veggie oil in his car. His fuel lines got clogged, supposedly from cholesterol in the oil, except you pointed out veggie oil doesn't have cholesterol. And Greg Earhart of Kenosha, Wisconsin, added this tip on fuel efficiency.
Hey, Marketplace Money, you missed out on something big last week in terms of looking for better mileage. One thing that I do is just drive the speed limit. Driving slower or going from 65 to 55 saves me about 20% and stretches my gas dollar. It's maybe a little annoying to the people behind me, but I take solace in knowing that they're saving money too.
Now, we were pretty clear last week that we were only talking cars, not alternatives. Still, a good number wanted to talk about your experiences with cheaper and greener options, including our very own senior web producer, Matt Berger. He downsized, somewhat reluctantly, to a one-car family more than a year ago.
I ride my bike to work. Well, sort of.
That's not a real bike.
Okay, it's a bike with a motor on it, but it gives me some oomph up the hills. And despite the office scorn, I have reasons for riding 15 miles a day from my house in South Pasadena to downtown Los Angeles. Yes, Los Angeles, where there's 1.5 cars for every person.
You're a cheapskate.
That's my wife, Mary. She has full use of the one car we do own. About a year ago, we moved to Los Angeles from rural Connecticut with our two kids.
Nina.
Yes,
I work. Nina.
What?
Nothing.
Everything is more expensive here. Groceries, housing, our daughter's preschool. We couldn't sell our house in Connecticut, so now we own there and we rent here.
I think if we had just decided that we had to have a car, a second car, we would have bought one. And the only difference would be we'd be in a lot of debt right now that we're not necessarily in.
Every day I woke up to catch the 647 bus outside our house. And an hour and two transfers later, I'd be downtown at the office.
You hated the bus. You always had to run to catch it, or you missed it, or you complained bitterly about it.
I was never too proud to beg for a ride, but it was a long shot since it meant convincing the kids to get dressed and in the car by 7 a.m.
Do you guys want to give me a ride, Maddie?
No.
Sometimes I could pay them off by giving them my bus fare. Mary, on the other hand, not so easy to convince early in the morning.
No.
Can I have a ride to work today?
No, tired, I'm sleepy.
So each day I made the best of the LA metro system. And the idea of paying off the first car and being able to buy a new one kept me motivated. But then one day, it was clear.
I think we always thought we'd have more money like later in a couple months, like when we got our tax return. And then we just never really seemed to have enough money to go buy a new car or even a used car.
With the rising price of gas, insurance, car payments, parking. My future was with the bus. Until RoboBike. Now my commute takes about 30 minutes and I actually enjoy it. We use the $300 a month we would have spent on the car on things like ballet lessons for the girls. And my wife is happy about it too. She gets to sleep in.
Have fun!
Marketplace senior web producer Matt Berger. You're probably wondering how his RoboBike works. Well, you can see it in action on our website at marketplace.org/money. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook. Next time, do you agonize over how much to tip? Good service? Bad service? Or maybe look to the sky for inspiration.
If it's sunny outside, you tip more. And that relationship between weather and tipping is as strong as the relationship between service and tipping.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director this week is Jeff Peters. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Tess back here next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.